morning, everyone. This meeting is called to order at 9:18 a.m., May 23, 2012. So before we proceed with any business, I think Mr. Smith has a statement to read.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State. Is required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official records of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Before we start regulations, let me inform everybody that Chairman Friedkin was unable to make this meeting or tomorrow's meeting. He is out of the country on business, but regrets not being here, so you're stuck with me. Okay, we'll call the Regulations Committee to order. And the first order of business is to approve the minutes from the March 28th meeting, which they've been previously distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Second.
Commissioner Scott. Second. Commissioner Jones. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Okay, number one, committee item number one, request permission to review rules. Ann Bright, please make your presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Ann Broad, General Counsel. The government code, the Administrative Procedure Act, requires that every agency go through a rule review process every 4 years. All regulations have to be reviewed. During the review, we have to assess whether the initial reasons for adopting them continue to be in effect. We publish notice that we're going to review the rules in the Texas Register, and then once we complete that process, the regulations are either readopted, adopted with changes, or repealed based on the review. We normally do these rule reviews in three meetings. The first one is a notified commission that we're going to start the rule review process, and then we'll publish notice of the review in the Texas Register. Then we will seek permission to publish any proposed changes that come out of the review. In the third meeting, we will seek adoption of any proposed rules. This slide is kind of busy, but it sort of shows you our schedule so that the three-meeting process for each chapter of the Administrative Code in which TPWD's rules are. So unless there's an objection, staff will begin the process of reviewing chapters 51, 52, 55, 60, and 61. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Anyone have any questions? I'm just curious why you picked this particular order. Is there any?
Frankly, I kind of inherited this order. I'm not sure. You mean like why we're reviewing these rules at this time?
Well, just instead of taking them in order, you're skipping from 52 to 55, for example. Is there any particular reason other than that's the way it's been done?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's how it. The rule review process started like in the early 2000s when the state agencies were required to do this. And I think when that initially happened, in order to spread them out, there was a decision made at some point to just start with these various chapters. And because it had to be reviewed every 4 years, we just continued on that. The only one that we really changed in terms of the schedule are shrimp. At one point, they kind of got out of sequence, and we sort of moved those back. There's no
will. Okay. Thank you. No further actions required. Committee item number two, voter education deferral rules. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Tim Spice.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Tim Spice. I'm the voter education manager, and with me is Jeff Parrish. He's the voting law administrator, and he's the person that started the deferral process before I became the voter education manager. A brief history on voter education. In 1997, a law was passed that required people of a certain age to take voter education, and that was between the ages of 13 and 17. Prior to 1997, it was a voluntary program. In the last legislative session, they passed the born after date of September 1st, 1993. So all persons born after have to take voter education to operate a vessel alone. Annually, we certify around 10,000 people a year in voter education. Currently, the fees are for our online programs, $20. Volunteer-led is $20. We have ag science teachers and other volunteers that are certified to teach. And if Jeff or I want to teach the course, it's $5. The proposed deferral fee would be $10, and that is similar to the Hunter education. The deferral requirement under the provisions of House Bill 1395 enacted by the 82nd Texas Legislature in the regular session, Parks and Wildlife Code was amended to require the department to establish a voter education deferral program by rule. That's why I'm here. The proposed regulation is a one-time, three-consecutive-day deferral of voter education requirements for persons over the 18 years of age and older. It also proposes that we prohibit a person who purchases a voter education deferral from supervising the operation of a vessel of another. Currently, right now, 18-year-olds can supervise people underage on personal aircraft or another boat. And again, a $10 fee similar to the Hunter education deferral and issued also through the point of sale. This only affects voters born on or after September 1st, 1993. That also means that a person that's born before September 1st, 1993 can still operate a boat, can still supervise another person who does not have voter education. It increases in 1 year increments, so we have gradual growth, so we have knowledge of the program, just like voter education and the deferral, which means people that are 35 years old, our target demographic, won't be required to take it for 16 years. 31109 also states the Texas Parks and Wildlife Code that the court shall defer proceedings and allow a person 90 days to present written evidence that they've taken a course and have completed it, and they shall dismiss the charges. This is just like Hunter education. And, I thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions if you have them.
Any questions?
I have a question. In reading through the material, it seemed like this was set up with the idea that a customer who wants to buy a new boat can get this 3-day deferral, or he can go out and demo boats. Is that right? Or can anybody go that doesn't have a your boat registration? Can anybody go?
Commissioner, it's for anyone. Anyone that falls in that age group that wants to go operate a boat, and so your family's out on vacation, and the cousin or niece that's 17-year-old who wants to go ride a jet ski, they can get the deferral and still operate a jet ski. Or the adults, any one of us in this room can be on the boat and operate with them and supervise.
Any other comments, discussion?
And there's no limit to the 3-day deferral. You can get several of those over a period of months, years.
It was a one-time deferral. The idea is that we want them to take voter education. It makes it safer and a better recreational activity.
One time meaning once in your lifetime?
One time in your lifetime. Yes, sir.
What about for out-of-state people who are here? I should probably know how that works, but it's just, for instance, if somebody was cited and they were out of state, what would happen?
But if they were cited, ma'am, they would have 90 days and to take a voter education course, even in their own state, because we have reciprocity.
Okay.
And then the judge can dismiss it.
If just last question on that one-time issue. So I suppose that what they do is they have to pay the $10 to get the deferral. Do we then have a database of some sort where we know who has done that deferral, who has that deferral, so that if they come back next month and say, I want to try this boat out, this other boat out, or whatever, that it pops up?
Mr. Jones, we asked that question with the point of sale database, and that it's supposed to be handled through that point of sale. So if you get it one time and then you go back to a point of sale and try to get it again, it's supposed to restrict you from being able to purchase another.
But you can go to another point of sale.
It's all the same database.
Oh, it's all the same database, run by the state.
It's a contract, and I don't know who has the contract.
And maybe it'd be good for one of you to tell everybody about how long this course sounds like days. Tell them how long it should take somebody to take it online.
The boater education program is mandated through the Coast Guard and the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators. The classroom course has a 6-hour requirement. The online course has a timed 3-hour requirement.
But how long does it take to actually complete it? It's 3 hours.
It's a 3-hour minimum, sir.
And what is the minimum age? Minimum age a person can be to take the course.
Parks and Wildlife Code says 12.
Okay.
Any other comments, questions? Okay, thank you, Tim and Jeff. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 3, quail management regulatory recommendation, Mr. Robert Perez. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Robert Perez. I'm Gameway Program Leader, Wildlife Division. I'll be giving the quail management recommendation.
You better keep your distance. Commissioner Scotty may steal your tie.
I'm all right for a roll this morning.
When's Dan coming back?
I'll address the following 4 points, which include the outcome of a recent meeting of the Resident Gameboard Technical Committee in regard to quail harvest regulations. That particular committee is made up of staff biologists. I will also address current and proposed quail harvest data collection, current and proposed quail population index data collection, and lastly, a description of the focus area approach to quail conservation and restoration. First point. At the Commission's request, the Resident Game Bird Technical Committee recently met to discuss quail harvest regulations as they relate to conservation and population management. Based on the best available science, the recommendations of the March 7th Quail Science Meeting, and the guidance provided by this commission, the Technical Committee recommends no proposed changes be made to the current quail hunting regulations. And the committee also recommends that no subdivision of the current statewide season into regulatory zones, while staff will continue with and expand upon population harvest monitoring at the ecoregion level. Although quail population trends, and for that matter the challenges facing quail, differ among ecological regions, the current regulatory framework is appropriate for all regions. However, there is biological justification for different approaches to quail conservation in different regions of the state. For example, staff are currently developing focus areas for quail in the eastern state and third of the state, where populations persist at a low level, while continuing traditional approaches to conservation in the western two-thirds of the state, including textile guidance, habitat harvest recommendations. Next is the second point in regard to harvest data collection. The Parks and Wildlife Small Game Harvest Survey is appropriate for tracking statewide quail harvest trends, but currently does not clearly instruct hunters to report only wild quail harvest. As quail populations have declined, the use of pen-reared quail to supplement or replace wild quail hunts has become more common. Since hunter success likely differs between wild and pen-reared hunts, the Small Game Harvest Survey will now instruct hunters to only report wild quail harvest. Although the Small Game Harvest Survey provides valuable statewide harvest statistics, ecoregion estimates are less informative due to a small sample size. So in order to increase our knowledge and understanding of quail hunter behavior and success, staff have developed a quail hunter scorecard to provide additional information, including the distribution of harvest through time and quail harvested per day. A sample of previous small game harvest survey respondents who identified themselves as quail hunters will receive this hunter scorecard in the coming fall just prior to hunting season. Third point in regard to population data collection. The Parks and Wildlife August quail roadside surveys are highly predictive of hunter harvest at the ecoregion scale and provide a valuable index to populations. Surveys have been conducted since 1978, but over time, some of the survey routes may no longer meet the original criteria, which was that the routes be on all-weather road, have low vehicular traffic, and low human habitation. If too many routes no longer meet these criteria, the power of the survey can be possibly reduced. For this reason, staff will reevaluate all routes this coming August and take steps to ensure the survey continues to provide a valuable index. In 1988, Quail roadside counts were discontinued in the Black Mountain Prairies, Post Oak Savannah, and Piney Woods. The roadside technique is no longer or never was appropriate for collecting quail population data in these regions. Staff are developing monitoring protocols for use in focus areas to provide insight to population dynamics in regions with low-level quail population. And here you can see the current distribution of the 163 quail roadside counts, and also the three ecoregions previously mentioned where quail are not currently surveyed, shown there and highlighted in gray. And the final point in regard to focus area development, previously defined a focus area as being an area generally larger than a county but smaller than an ecoregion, with a boundary determined by opportunity, habitat potential, landowner and partner interest and participation. There are excellent examples of ongoing habitat restoration projects in Texas, including the Wildlife Habitat Federation, the Western Navarre Bobwhite Restoration Initiative, but monitoring has been a lacking component. Staff are interested in enhancing population monitoring efforts at the focus area scale to measure the impacts of habitat manipulation and develop models that can be reproduced in other areas with restoration potential. A grant proposal has been submitted for federal funding to support intense monitoring in three key areas of the state, shown here. As I mentioned, there are ongoing supported quail projects or initiatives in the red and yellow areas, and an initiative that's under development in the green area, which is part of the Eastern Rolling Plains, where staff are ramping up efforts and where UNT Quail has begun a program to restore bobwhite. The Western Navarro Bobwhite Restoration Initiative is shaded in red, and the Wildlife Habitat Federation is shaded in yellow. The development of a monitoring program is essential to evaluate the effects of these initiatives on quail and grassland bird populations. Of course, staff and partners continue to work outside of these shaded areas, but the purpose of this project is to intensively monitor within a small area. I would also like to mention that the department will be hosting a joint meeting of the Quail Roundtable and the Up and Game Bird Advisory Committee in early June to discuss the future direction and needs of quail conservation in Texas. That concludes my presentation.
Anybody have any comments, questions? Yeah, sure.
Just walk through again why the suggestion to have multiple regions didn't get any traction. It seemed like it made sense to give the flexibility in the future with very little effort.
Harvest is not the first choice of a tool to impact populations at that level. And some of the information that was previously presented to this commission indicated that it would have the most impact when needed least. So a reduction in bag limits or season length would affect the numbers of quail harvested most where there was a great quail year. And it would affect quail numbers the least when they needed help in a drought type year. There are differences between ecological regions. Obviously, populations have responded differently for different reasons. But the best way to get a response in a population, we think, and according to the national model, is to go on the ground and with a focused approach and get a response from populations on the ground through habitat manipulation.
But you don't see the need anytime in the future to have a flexibility between the Panhandle and South Texas.
The data that we've
either in bag limits or season,
according to our population index, there really were no significant differences between those two regions of the state, the High Plains and South Texas.
Commissioner, if I could, I think that was a good biological basis for that recommendation. But another issue was just hunter confusion. And we were a little concerned that if we set up zones that didn't have any differences between zones, that we might unnecessarily confuse hunters. And so we felt like that option would still be there for the commission in the future if the biological data suggested that we ought to have bag and season limit changes between zones. So that was another reason that we considered.
Thank you, sure, Karen.
I know that obviously you've talked to all the other groups and exchanged information, but I'm thinking specifically of like Cesar Clayburgh. Do you have to do your own research or can you take their data? and then put it into the mix, or how does that work?
We have taken all data into consideration, and it was a project that was funded by Parks and Wildlife through Sage Labor, the Sustained Yield Project that has been come to be referred to as, which indicated that to sustain populations on any given property, you need to stay below a 20% harvest of that population. And the data went on to further suggest that most people don't, even when they try, surpass a 20% harvest.
Thank you.
How was the, on the focus areas, how, for example, the Eastern Rolling Plains, which it looks to me like that may be Callahan, Shackelford, and Stevens at the bottom, is that right?
And Clay and Shackelford Distance.
How did you select that, or how was that selected?
The intent of this particular study is to go in places of the state where there are still remnant populations, low level, but they haven't been gone for a long period of time, and to see if we can go in and manipulate smaller, within these areas there'll be certain treatment sites, and within those treatment sites that would be intensively manipulated, we would be counting birds within and outside of those treatment areas to measure an effect on quail and certain grassland birds.
Well, those are certainly, those three counties used to have vibrant quail populations.
Not that long ago, yes. Yeah. Right.
One other question. You said the roadside counts, you're going to, in August, look at redoing the reevaluation of the routes this August. Are you going to reevaluate them before you actually conduct them in August?
The observer, the biologist, will be given a form, and while he conducts the survey, he'll be taking extra data, and when he's completed, he'll go back, count the number of houses, he'll be recording the number of vehicles he passes on the road, and any other structures that might interfere with that being a viable route. So we'll ask him to run it twice, once at a higher speed than the other.
Right. Okay. And the other thing I wanted to ask Carter to mention was a recent, I guess a report, what you call Lenny Branch. Would you tell everybody about that, because I thought it was important and significant.
Sure, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope that all of you had a chance to see a report that Dr. Lenny Brennan, one of the foremost quail scientists in the state, who works at the Cedar Claybrook Wildlife Research Institute, prepared and published in their notes on quail management, quail conservation, and quail hunting. Really talking about the long history of science that has guided the commission's and department's decision with respect to quail management. And so if you hadn't had a chance to take a look at it, we'd certainly encourage you to do so. Cedar Claybrook was essentially expressing the strong support for the commission's long-standing interest in the science and making sure that the decisions were predicated on that, and I just encourage you all to take a strong look at it. It was an excellent article.
Any other comments or questions?
And I don't want to get into all the details of this, but have you heard anything about research out there that indicated, I'm not sure what the condition is called, but essentially worms in the eyes of the quail?
Eye worms, right?
Is that what they're called? Eye worms?
Eye worms would be.
Well, that's a big one.
You can say worm, but we don't. It's essentially a parasitic. Part of the life cycle of parasites within the eye of a quail. As that individual gets older, the number of worms can increase within the eye. And the data in the Rolling Plains showed that about 50% of all birds collected had some number of eye worms in their eye. Now the number of worms it takes to start interfering with a quail's sight or ability to avoid predator is unknown, and how long it takes for them to build a parasite load is unknown. The only information that we really have is between now and historic densities of worms within the eye was that there was work done back in the 60s that showed a very similar prevalence rate of about 50% of the birds had eye worms. So it's a natural parasite of the bird. It's just whether or not, for various reasons in certain years, maybe that parasite load is higher. So it's pretty early in the research there to find, you know, if that could be a potential cause for a population to have problems.
Okay, so. So the parasite presence in the eyes of the quail isn't of itself killing the quail.
Correct.
What the effect may be is that if the population of parasites in the eye increases to the level of the bird can't see or evade predators, then it could possibly cause the population.
Okay, at least for that individual at a population level, we'd have to be looked at close. Mm-hmm. Quail normally don't live that long. So I don't know how long it takes to get, you know, hundreds of worms in the eye.
Right.
So it's a question that still remains unanswered. But there is at least one researcher that's looking into it.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Your action is required. Committee item 4, floating cabins, permit rules. Cody Jones, we have recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Cody Jones. I am a lieutenant game warden in the marine enforcement section and the administrator of the Coastal Floating Cabin Program. I'm here this morning to present proposed changes to the regulations governing the permitting of floating cabins. As you may recall, in 2001, the Texas legislature passed Senate Bill 1573, which sought to regulate the number of floating cabins in the coast. The regulatory authority was granted to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department at that time. A floating cabin is defined as a structure securely moored in the coastal waters of this state, which is used for habitation or shelter and is not routinely used for transportation. In 2001, a total of 151 permits were issued for coastal floating cabins. Currently, only 145 permits remain. All 6 of the permits that have expired are due to permittees' non-interest and renewal. Under current regulations, all floating cabin permits expire August 31st of each year, and the renewal materials must be submitted before this date. However, I should point out that the language also allows an additional 90 days after expiration of the renewal. This causes some confusion. If a permit is not renewed by the end of the 90 days, then the permit becomes ineligible for renewal, and the cabin must be removed at the owner's expense. Under the proposed regulation, first, a reference to the original regulatory deadline is eliminated since it's no longer necessary. Second, the language is clarified to state that the deadline for submission of renewal materials would be 90 days from the date the permit expires rather than before the expiration date. Third, the proposed language would state that upon the expiration of a permit, all permittees would be mailed a notice from the department and would be given an opportunity to request review of the expired permit within 10 days after the department's mailing. In addition, it creates a review panel made up of senior department managers, including the deputy executive director or his or her designees, the director of law enforcement or his or her designee, and the director of coastal fisheries or his or her designee. This panel would be able to review the late renewal application and make findings on its review, which is consistent with the wildlife permit review process, which is already in place. And finally, to eliminate any confusion, the term owner will be changed to permittee to remain consistent within the rule. As of 9 a.m. this morning, we've received public comment from 2 people, 1 in favor and 1 opposed. The negative comment primarily focused on deregulating floating cabins to save state money for use in state parks. If you have any questions, be happy to entertain them at this time.
Questions? Comments? Cody, I have one. When the expiration occurs and we send out the notice to all the permittees,
yes, sir.
Do we propose that there be a fee associated with that expired permit to cover the costs of us handling all that?
When looking at the rule, the regulatory didn't allow for that fee to be in place, so there's no avenue to put a fee in place at this time. It was statutory only.
How many, I think this was asked last time, I can't remember what the number was. How many of these permits are currently issued?
At the inception of the program, there was 151. Currently, there's 145 permits.
Probably a little bit off subject, but the cabins, fishing cabins you see on islands all up and down the coast, are those? Do we permit those, or are those permitted by another source?
We do not. The General Land Office permits those cabins, those structures that are on the spool banks. They have about 450 of those permits out there for that program, and it's run quite differently in respect.
Good question.
No.
Neither. Anybody else? Comments? Questions? Okay, Cody, thank you. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. This committee has now completed its business, so we'll move to the Conservation Commission.